Priya, what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. Libya's warring factions agree to create a unity government. Political chaos and factional fighting has engulfed that country since the overthrow of its dictator, Muammar Gaddafi, in 2011. It remains unclear whether the agreement will draw wide enough support to end the fighting. There is no immediate reaction from the country's two rival legislatures. After being released from Iran as part of a prisoner exchange, a group of Americans got to meet Monday with family and supporters. Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian met with senior editors from his newspaper at the German hospital where he is recovering. Former U.S. Marine Amir Hekmati met with family members, his congressman, and press. He said Iranians did not expect the U.S. government to try so hard to get him released.
Even the Iranian officials who were our captors essentially were amazed and had asked us, why is it that they're, you know, working so hard for you? And I just said, well, that's America, and they love their citizens. And even the other Iranian prisoners were really moved.
American pastor Saeed Abedini is also undergoing treatment at a hospital, a fourth American. Not much is known about him or even why he was in Iran in the first place. The humanitarian organization Doctors Without Borders has denounced Europe's migration policy of deterrence. They call the policy a catastrophic failure that has endangered asylum seekers and created more business for smugglers. Doctors Without Borders Tuesday issued a report titled Obstacle Course to Europe. The U.S. Supreme Court announced Tuesday it will hear a case challenging President Barack Obama's plan to protect more than 4 million undocumented immigrants from deportation. This is VOA News. The United Nations says in a new report that Iraq's war with Islamic State militants led to thousands of civilian deaths. Lisa Schlein reports.
The report says that during the period from May to October of last year, nearly 4,000 civilians were killed and more than 7,000 wounded. About half of these deaths took place in the capital, Baghdad. UN monitors blame most of these deaths on Islamic State. It says victims include those perceived as being opposed to the terror group's ideology and rule, such as government civil servants, doctors and lawyers, journalists and tribal and religious leaders. It says women and children are subject to sexual violence, particularly in the form of sexual slavery. Lisa Schlein, Geneva.
The International Monetary Fund has lowered its global economic growth forecast for 2016, citing risks to emerging markets due to a slowing Chinese economy. Maurice Ostfeld is an IMF economic counselor.
We may be in for a bumpy ride this year, especially in the emerging and developing economies.
The Washington-based fund said Tuesday it believes the world economy will grow 3.4% in 2016 and 3.6% in 2017. An advocacy group in the U.S. has become the first group to sue to block President Barack Obama's executive order calling for more background checks on gun buyers. Freedom Watch contends that Mr. Obama did not have the legal authority to expand the government's background checks absent congressional action. The right to bear arms is enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. Congress has rebuffed attempts to tighten gun control laws in the country. Gun advocates say that stiffer laws will not keep criminals from securing weapons and only serve to inconvenience law-abiding citizens. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has vowed al-Shabaab militants will pay a heavy price for an attack Friday that reportedly killed dozens of Kenyan soldiers in southern Somalia. Speaking in a nationwide broadcast Tuesday, Mr. Kenyatta said, "Kenya is unbowed." Islamic State Tuesday acknowledged the death of a terrorist nicknamed Jihadi John, known for beheading Western hostages. The site intelligence monitoring website says Islamic State eulogized the killer. In its English-language magazine, the Pentagon said in November that it was reasonably certain a drone strike in Syria killed Jihadi John. Jihadi John's real name was Mohammed Mwazi, a British citizen of Arab descent. Officials in northwestern Pakistan say a suspected suicide blast Tuesday killed at least 12 people. Many more were wounded in the attack. The Taliban claims responsibility. In Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today's Wednesday, January 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberia's military says it is ready to assume complete security responsibilities when the mandate of the UN mission ends later this year.
Yeah, to the point where all of our forces, all of the 2,000 plus personnel of the armed forces in Liberia, have been going through different kinds of training, including our participation in the UN mission. So we are very confident in the capability of the armed forces of Liberia.
Brownie Samuka is Liberia's defense minister. A journalist and two human rights activists have gone on trial in Zimbabwe for taking pictures of so-called protected areas. And thousands of newly displaced persons in Niger are in need of water and shelter.
UNHCR is redirecting available resources to try and meet the needs that we're seeing there. We're calling on donors for extra help to support the vulnerable population.
Adrian Edwards is spokesman for the UNHCR. The man-made green belt of vegetation surrounding Niger's capital is said to be under threat from residents. The U.S. Interior Secretary visits Africa to fight wildlife trafficking, and an activist wants African immigrants to get involved in the U.S. political process. Those stories, plus Mark Olman Sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberia's defense minister says the military is ready to take over the nation's security responsibilities after the United Nations mission in Liberia, also known as UNMIL, ends this year. Brownie Samukai says the 2,000-plus strong Liberian military has been undergoing different types of training in preparation for the UNMIL drawdown. But on Monday this week, Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara vowed that he will plead with UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to extend UNMIL's mandate beyond 2016 until after Liberia's 2017 elections are concluded. Defense Minister Samukai says the Ivorian leader was speaking in political context that the presence of the international community would lend credibility to the outcome of Liberia's 2017 presidential election.
From our side, we believe that the roles and responsibilities that we have are easily executable because we have been doing the preparedness for a little bit over a year and a half. We are to the point where all of our forces, all of the 2,000-plus personnel of the armed forces in Liberia have been going through different kinds of training, different kinds of operations, different kinds of scenario exercises, including our participation in the UN mission. So we are very confident in the capability of the armed forces of Liberia.
The president of Liberia and you just returned from Cote d'Ivoire. The president of Ivory Coast, Alassane Ouattara, has vowed that he's going to ask the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to extend the mandate of the United Nations mission in Liberia beyond 2016. Is that a view that the military or the government shares?
Let me put it this way. I think President Ouattara was very honest in his assessment of the situation. And I think he was looking with regard to the political situation happening in the country. One needs to understand that the president of the international community during an electoral period is pivotal to the transition process from one administration to the other. And I think it is within that context in which he was speaking that the president of the United Nations during that period of 2017 is very pivotal to ensuring that the environment is conducive, not only conducive, but also the environment has a very high degree of credibility to ensure that the results of those elections are accepted by the international community and as well as Liberians.
Mr. Minister, even if the context within which the Ivorian president spoke is correct, you've just said that the Liberian military is prepared. Why can't they do that without the help of army?
Let me put it this way. The military has no influential part to play in the electoral process. The military simply has unique capabilities in terms of logistics and transportation and the facilitation of individuals from point A to point B. The military cannot and will not be able to influence the outcome or the process of the election that will be held in 2017. So the presence of the military and the preparedness of the military is simply to suggest its capacity to manage the security situation come 2017 along the border in the frontier to our country.
Mr. Minister, I understand it will take about, say, $100 million to beef up Liberian security to be able to take over from UNMIL after UNMIL leaves. Does the government have that money?
No, I think the money you're talking about or the qualification that you're talking about is based upon a 3 to 5 years capacity building, resource mobilization, and the whole nine yards that are needed. Election is 2017, so it's within a five-year context. So we don't need $100 million to get us there. What is needed, and that is what the government is doing now, the government has already made $10 million United States dollars available to support the preparation of the Liberian security forces, including the military, heading towards 2017. They're also making an additional $5 million available to support the armed forces of Liberia and other security agencies in their preparedness about 2017.
Brownie Samuka is Liberia's defense minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. The UN Refugee Agency says tens of thousands of newly displaced people in Niger are in desperate need of international assistance. The UNHCR says about 100,000 people have fled in recent weeks from attacks launched by Nigeria's Boko Haram insurgents. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says aid agencies are struggling to help the newly displaced who are living in makeshift shelters along the volatile Niger-Nigeria border. UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards tells VOA the people are a mix of internally displaced from Niger, some of whom have been forced to flee several times, and Nigerian refugees. He says they are scattered along one of the most difficult and remote areas in that part of West Africa.
People are spread out over a wide area. This is contributing to the difficulties in reaching them. There are no camps as such there. As I said, it's a spontaneous settlement environment. Security is certainly a problem, and this is something we are talking to the authorities about. So far, the military authorities haven't been able to provide protection across this wide area. That's something that has to be looked at.
Edwards describes the situation as very serious. He says there are acute shortages of adequate shelter and non-food items for the displaced. He adds there also is an acute shortage of money. He notes the UNHCR has received less than half of the $51 million it needs to run its Niger operation.
UNHCR is redirecting available resources to try and meet the needs that we're seeing there. We're calling on donors for extra help to support the vulnerable population. Local officials expect more people to flee the volatile border area when the dry season returns, which I understand is at the end of February typically, and when Nigerian military operations resume in the area.
Edwards says newly arrived families have few sanitation facilities and have to walk long distances to fetch water. He says the medical charity Doctors Without Borders is providing health care and sanitation, but it too is strapped for funds. He says many children are unable to attend school. For now, he notes, the World Food Program has enough supplies on hand to meet food demands. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The man-made greenbelt of vegetation surrounding Niger's capital, Niamey, is under threat from residents who are building within the protected area, says Manu Bage, the Director General for the Protection of Vegetation in the Niger government's Ministry of Agriculture. The greenbelt, built in the 1960s to be 1 kilometer wide and 25 kilometers long, encircles the city to protect it from weather elements such as heavy dust. Bagge tells Ricky Stryak that the city authorities are even playing a role in the destruction.
The challenge about plantation we have in Niamey town is that the Niamey town authorities are building some houses, offices in the plantation. From them to protect this plantation because of the importance of this plantation, but we have seen that people are destroying this plantation and the offices are destroying too because of the town extension.
What risks does Niamey face if this green belt around the city is destroyed or is drastically reduced?
Waiting to the authorities, environmental services, and some other ministries, and the Niamey town authority to access, protect this green plantation, take some time to add some new plantations, because everybody knows that this kind of green plantation around the town is very, very important thing for the protecting of people and the building in Niamey.
What is it protecting them from?
The green protection, we have few kinds of importance of protection. First, it protects the town from dust and other things in the rainy season. You know that we are in the Sahel. In the Sahel, we have some tornado. But just second, people can take in the plantation from medicals, traditional medicals. And you have other importance that tree are, the respiration of tree is giving oxygen, taking out the dioxide. So you have every kind of importance of these plantations.
There's traditional medicine that people take from some of these trees. Is that what you said?
Yes. Traditional medicine. You can see if people are needing wood for construction and other things, they can preserve on these trees, on the surveillance or on the forestry offices.
Elections are coming up in Niger. Is there a candidate for president who is, you know, more environmentally friendly, or someone who is really campaigning that more needs to be done for things such as the Green Belt, or are most of the candidates not talking about this issue?
We don't have any candidate that pronounced to protect, especially environment protection. But in their program, everyone has something about the environment protection. But now we are in the campaign. Now we can listen to the candidates and their program to understand and to hear what their intention about the environment protection.
That was Manu Bage, Director General for the Protection of Vegetation in the Niger Ministry of Agriculture. He was speaking with Ricky Shryak. Today's Wednesday, January 20th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Let's send a shout out to listeners on Sky 106.6 FM in Freetown, Sierra Leone, and KISS 104 FM in Bow, Sierra Leone. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. The trial of a Harare-based journalist and two human rights activists accused of illegally taking pictures at a protected area in Zimbabwe opened yesterday in the capital, with the accused denying the charges against them. Thomas Chiripasi reports from Harare.
The trial of freelance journalist Edgar Gweshe and two human rights activists, Donald Makubaza and Charles Chidakwa, accused of illegally taking pictures at the Harare Remand Prison sometime last year, opened at the Harare Magistrates Court, with the defense team calling Gweshe to the witness stand. Gweshe told the court that he was outside the 100-meter radius prohibited by the law for anyone to take pictures of a protected area. The accused's lawyer, Tondere Batasara of the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights, told Studio 7 that Gweshe and the two activists are denying the charges leveled against them.
Today, Mr. Gweshe, who is the first accused person, testified in court, insisting on what he has already said in his defense outline, that he never received any instruction not to take pictures.
During cross-examination by prosecutor Francisca Mkumbiri, Gweshe told the court that there was no way that pictures of the Harare Remand Prison, allegedly found in his flash disk, could have been taken by him because he had no computer during the time of his arrest to enable him to transfer the pictures that he took from his camera to the memory stick. The trial continues tomorrow, with Makubaza and Chidakwa expected to take to the witness stand. Harare-based freelance journalist Watmo Makokova says media freedom is now under siege in Zimbabwe.
Clearly, journalism is under attack, especially from this political front. If you look at it, it shows that there are hidden agendas that are rather political, which are pushing hidden agendas, maybe trying to deter journalists from practicing their duty freely.
Charges against Gweshe and his co-accused arose after they allegedly took pictures of civil society activists who had visited the leaders of the National Vendors Union of Zimbabwe in prison following a blitz on street traders. Authorities say the prison where Gweshe and his co-accused took pictures of the civic leaders falls under protected areas. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
U.S. Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell arrives in Africa this week to examine the issue of wildlife trafficking. She told journalists Tuesday that Washington had a role to play to end the illegal trading of wildlife and its products. Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare.
Before a visit to Gabon, Kenya and South Africa, Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell said the Obama administration is concerned about the rise in cases of wildlife trafficking from Africa to Asia, Europe, and the United States. She explains why the United States last year banned lion and elephant trophies from Zimbabwe.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service does not believe that sufficient measures are being put in place in that country to support the conservation efforts in local communities. That is the position that we've taken. Zimbabwe has not got a program that addresses those issues, where Namibia does. So it's, I think, very important that countries work with us and work with local communities to make sure that the resources get to the people.
President Robert Mugabe's government and tourism operators argue the ban affects revenue generation for Zimbabwe. But Zimbabwe continues exporting wildlife, animals, and products to Asia as part of its, quote, Look East Police, unquote, adopted in the early 2000s after most Western countries imposed sanctions on Mr. Mugabe and his senior officials following reports of election rigging and human rights abuses. Last month, Zimbabwe said it had exported elephants to China as part of its efforts to reduce the animal's population, which Harare says is now affecting the ecosystem in the African country. During an Africa visit that begins Thursday, Jewo is expected to meet with government officials, non-governmental organizations, and conservation leaders. According to the U.S. State Department, African countries are major sources for ivory, rhino horn, and other illegally taken flora and fauna destined predominantly for markets in Asia. Jewel traveled to China and Vietnam last summer in a similar effort to further work to crack down on black markets at home and internationally. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
He was the first Nigerian-American superdelegate for the state of Maryland at the Democratic National Convention in 2012. As this year's presidential election heats up, Sylvester Okere is calling on the African immigrant community to get involved now by getting to know their candidates, attending rallies, and talking to people about their candidates. Mariama Diallo caught up with the businessman and political activist and prepared this report.
On a crisp day in Washington, Sylvester Okere says his community has to educate itself on how it could be affected by this year's presidential election.
Many of us think that politics is only on the day of election, but this calls for us to get involved both in rallies, in door knocking, you know, educating our community to get involved.
It's a crowded field of presidential hopefuls.
Signing legislation repealing every word of Obamacare.
Now is not the time for establishment politics. Now is the time for a political revolution.
For Okere, only one of these candidates has the credentials for the job.
I can pick any candidate, I can choose anyone, but I think because for the interest of our community, I will talk about Hillary Clinton. None of them has the information about other parts of the world like Hillary Clinton. She has served as the Secretary of State. She knows not only Africa, she knows everywhere.
We shouldn't let anybody on the public stage say that we are mean-spirited, that we are going to build walls.
We will build a wall.
He says for many, immigration is the number one topic, not for him.
I happen to be an ex-immigration officer, and I know the rules and do's and don'ts, and know the importance of, you know, the fear when you are in a land where you don't know anybody. You know, so the fear is there. But the most important thing also is our economic flourishment, because we all came here for one reason, education, and to be able to better our homes. And there is no how you're going to do it if you are not economically, you know, stable.
As a former superdelegate, he was in the heart of the Democratic Convention 4 years ago.
Superdelegate gives you access to everywhere in the convention grounds. I was able to comb every nook and corner of the convention that met all the, you know, top-class individuals that are there, all the elected officials, and everyone that came to the convention.
He says his work in 2012 to re-elect President Obama was relentless, talking to people at metro stations and providing his office for phone banking, even driving people to the polling centers. But he says it paid off when Obama won. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with football. Mali twice came from behind to hold Uganda to a 2-2 draw at the Orange African Nations Championships at the Umuganda Stadium in Gishenyi, some 160 kilometers northwest of the Rwanda capital, Kigali, on Tuesday. Erisa Sekisambu and Captain Farouk Mia scored for Uganda, while Sekou Koita and Hamidou Sinayoko replied for Mali. Earlier on at the same venue, Group D action commenced with the Zambezi River Derby pitting Zambia against Zimbabwe. The experience of veterans Isaac Chansa and captain Christopher Katongo, both recalled to the Zambian team just before the tournament, paid off. Katongo provided the through pass that saw Chansa score in the 58th minute to lift Zambia to a 1-0 triumph. Today, Wednesday, attention returns to the Amahoro Stadium in Kigali for the start of the second round of the preliminaries. Hosts Rwanda seek their second victory when they tackle Gabon, and then Morocco encounter the Ivory Coast. In tennis, Tunisian Ones Jabeur beat the Ukraine's Olga Friedman 0-6, 6-2, 6-4 to win the women's singles final at the Daytona Beach Tennis Tournament in Florida State in the United States of America on Sunday. In squash, Egyptians Mohamed El Shorbagi and Nour El Serbini were crowned winners at the J.P. Morgan Squash Tournament of Champions in New York City in the United States of America. El Shorbagi, who is the world's top seed, edged Britain's Nick Matthews by 3-2 to win the men's final, while El Serbini dismissed Amanda Shobi of the United States of America 3-1 to claim the women's title. Finally, African champions Algeria edged Slovenia's top club Maribor Branik 29-26 in the final build-up match in the Slovenian capital Ljubljana. Earlier on, the Algerians won their build-up matches in Montenegro and Serbia. They arrive in Cairo, Egypt today, Wednesday, to defend their title at the Africa Men's Handball Championships. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Libya's warring factions have agreed to create a unity government, hoping to end the fighting and chaos that has engulfed the country since the overthrow of strongman Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. The United Nations mediated the agreement at a conference in the Tunisian capital, Tunis, but it remains unclear whether it will draw wide support to end the bloodshed in Libya. And Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has vowed al-Shabaab militants will pay a heavy price for the attack Friday that reportedly killed dozens of Kenyan soldiers in southern Somalia. That is it for this Wednesday, January 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barty in Washington, hoping that all of you in Africa will have a very good day.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. Peace talks between the Burundian government and the opposition groups have been postponed, with no word on when they may resume. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss the crisis in Burundi. That's next time on VOA Africa.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in Feast your ears and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.